Welcome to A Life in Biography. I'm talking today with Henry R. Schlesinger, author of Honey Trapped, Sex, Betrayal, and Weaponized Love. Henry, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and then how you got interested in this subject?
Okay. I'm a journalist and an author, and I've been writing about espionage going on 20 years. This subject kind of appealed to me. Because it's one of the oldest pieces of tradecraft. You can actually trace honey traps back to the Bible, Samson and Delilah, or you can go into the Epic of Gilgamesh, and there's a honey trap used there. And it's been used for so long because it's effective. And I just wanted to trace the history of it from ancient times to the modern day. Today, the modern day is, it's most often used, or it's starting to be used in the world, in the cyber world, where there isn't any real physical contact.
And how effective is a honey trap?
It depends on the operation. There are variations of it. A honey trap could be, you know, loosely defined, a dating app that you download. And after, you know, talking to a person online, and that dating app that you download takes control of your phone. It can turn on the microphone, it can turn on GPS, it can access emails. Those are very effective. It depends on which variation you're using and the person who's the target. There are multiple instances where the target just refused to cooperate, and it wasn't effective at all.
Yeah, I can imagine that. What have been some of the most effective, I guess you'd call them spies, since they're using their honey traps? Maybe give us a few examples from your book.
Well, Samson and Delilah, she was a very effective honey trap.
Yeah.
you know, and she's probably the best known in history. There are other ones that... There are other ones that go throughout. One that wasn't effective, well, she was effective as a public relations campaign, was Mata Hari. She was captured by the French and used as a public relations or a propaganda tool. And very, very effective as that. You know, she was the ultimate femme fatale, and she's grown into kind of mythic proportions over the years, in part because of the propaganda campaign that the French launched, and in part because of the Greta Garbo movie. And then there was a store of publicity photos from her stage act. So, you know, in terms of being a honey trap public relations coup, she was very effective.
Yeah. So there must be various techniques and various motivations. Obviously, sex is for someone who's the mark, someone who's caught in a honey trap. Sexuality, the sex of the person is the allure. But what about the other side of it, the person who's setting up the honey trap? Why are they doing that?
They're doing it to coerce a person one way or another. You can blackmail them into giving up information that they have access to. Or you can use pillow talk. They'll willingly give it up to maintain a relationship.
I would imagine that, I know you don't think of yourself as a biographer per se, but I would imagine for anyone investigating the life of people involved in honey traps and the women or men, because sometimes it's men who have the sexual allure, it must be difficult to sort out the truth from the lies they tell about their own activities.
Sure. Well, that's a problem with writing about espionage in general.
Yeah.
The misconceptions are so deeply ingrained in the general public. The James Bond image of the spy is so deeply ingrained that if you're writing about espionage, you're constantly fighting against James Bond. Real life spies aren't anything like James Bond. Many of them are professorial. You know, some of them are, pose as diplomats or military personnel. The most effective spies you wouldn't notice in a crowded room. The old saying is that, the perfect spy has trouble getting the attention of a waiter.
Yeah, yeah. I'm going to quote a little bit from my New York Sun review of your book, which will give, I think, readers some of the flavor, too. I'm talking about women and men who can be the honey traps. And you use this term Romeo spies. They don't have to deck themselves out like Judith. The German Democratic Republic, East Germany in the Battle of Cold War days, ran several Romeo agents, none of whom seems to have been especially handsome or stylish.
Right.
Why would a West German woman fall for an overweight East German spy? All sorts of reasons. The spy could present himself as a charming, mature, protective older man, pretending, perhaps, to be in the employ of a West German ally who, after all, ought to know the secrets of their own side. Right. Then you describe these women who enjoy thinking of themselves as being sort of at the center of history, handled by an authoritative-looking gentleman who made spying seem both exciting and ennobling, as if some small part of the fate of nations pivoted on a single woman with a camera and copying machine and a lover who treated her to happy holidays.
Sure, that was one of the most effective Romeo spy operations in history. It was launched by Stasi, Marcus Wolf, who is a kind of a genius, an evil genius. Some people compare him to Carla in the Le Carré novels.
Oh, yeah.
What he did was he recognized something in Germany, which was there was a dearth, there was a shortage of available men because of two world wars. And women, because there was a shortage of men, women were also occupying positions within the intelligence community and within government that they normally wouldn't have occupied prior to World War I or the interwar years. So he recognized the shortage of men, and he recognized the placement of women in positions of power. And what he did was he launched a Romeo spy offensive. And they were seen as good guys. They weren't particularly handsome. They were stable, right? And most importantly or significantly, they were able to understand the woman. Because, of course, the East Germans already had a dossier on her. So they knew what kind of food she liked. They knew what kind of music she liked. They knew what she liked to do, where she'd like to go on vacations, any hobbies she had, what kind of friends. So,
They sound just like biographers.
Right, they were kind of biographers. They had the dossiers, and the Romeo spies were able to worm their way into their hearts, in part, just by being charming, and in part because they already knew the woman from the dossiers that were built up.
Have you interviewed or talked with any of these, shall we call them honeys, or is that too dangerous?
It's very difficult to get a hold of them. I've talked to people who have known them as friends and acquaintances.
Yeah.
None of their victims. But, they were non-alerting. They did nothing to call attention to themselves outside of the person they were targeting.
Right. So some of them, I would guess, would be even hard to track down.
Sure. They're very secretive people. They're spies.
Yeah. There's one figure you mentioned in your book that listeners may very well be familiar with, or once the name is mentioned, they may say, "Oh, now who was that?" That was Maria Butina.
Right. She was a Russian operative who came over, and she targeted a longtime Republican operative, who was good at fundraising and that kind of thing. The thing that she did that's really interesting and is new is she had her picture taken with a great many Republican, lawmakers and policymakers and
movers
and shakers, including the NRA people. If you go on social media, if you go on some of the, you know, websites, they'll all make, you know, lewd comments about how she was sleeping with all of these guys. And in reality, you know, the chances of her sleeping with, you know, these guys were very slim. The point, I believe, was that she was having her picture taken with them.
Yeah.
And those pictures were going on her social media accounts.
Sure.
Facebook pages. And they were burnishing her conservative credentials.
It seems like a natural point for her to use in the age of selfies.
Right, yeah. She was, you know, if you have your picture taken with the head of the NRA, or if you have your picture taken with a high-ranking Republican Senate leader, and you put it on Facebook, well, look who she's hanging out with.
Yeah.
It was a brilliant strategy. Sex wasn't involved there. I would, you know, stress that.
Yeah.
You know, it would be remote in the extreme.
Yeah.
The point was the pictures.
Yeah, yeah. There's a great irony here. I mean, the Republican Party until the recent years was so identified with the Cold War and anti-communism and even anti-Russian, you might say, and suspicions, and they're infiltrating our nation and they're corrupting our morals. And now it looks like we've been corrupted.
I don't think so. I think this was a small, well, it wasn't a small operation, but it was, you know, it was one operation.
Yeah, yeah.
The thing that was interesting about it is that it began in Russia. It began in Moscow. She had a front organization called the Right to Bear Arms, which, you know, was supposedly aimed at loosening Russia's gun laws. It was a bogus organization. Russia is never going to loosen its gun laws, but it attracted the attention of the NRA, and that was her in.
Yeah, yeah.
But, she actually held rallies, and she, you know, wrote editorials. It was a brilliant operation. By every account, she's a brilliant person.
And she went back to the Soviet, well, it's not the Soviet Union, she went back to Russia.
And now she's a politician.
Yeah, incredible. What a story.
Right. It's in researching her, I went to I was struck by what she was wearing.
Yeah.
In her photos with the lawmakers. And I went to some fashion consultants and interviewed them. And 201, they described what she was wearing as middle American mid-level mall attire.
Hmm.
So she wasn't dressing in slinky dresses. She wasn't dressing in couture. She was dressing in, you know, bargain or mid-priced dresses that were very modest. And, you know, if you look at her, she doesn't look any different than any other woman who you would see at a Midwest or, you know, Washington barbecue on a Sunday after church.
That's really interesting. I mean, rather than sort of the classic or conventional idea of a honey trap.
The femme fatale and the slinky.
Yes.
The Natasha Fatale from Boris and Natasha.
Right.
She was dressed very modestly. She showed a passion for all things Disney.
Ah.
She even went on a Disney cruise with the Republican operative she was living with.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one person she was sleeping with, I guess. They went on a Disney cruise. He went to Russia and they sang a duet of Beauty and the Beast, which is painful.
Yeah. So she sort of became a pal. She was palling around.
She was palling around. She was saying our interests are the same. We're interested in being, you know, allies. And, you know, it was the same old, same old.
Yeah. But she makes it all seem just sort of, you know, innocuous, recreational.
Right. And not sex, just, you know, we have compatible political interests and goals.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, that's, I wonder how many Butinas there are out there.
Yeah, she went to gun shows.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
She went to fundraising events and, you know, she had, she did sleep with somebody else, the an executive who later went on to be, you know, in the White House meetings.
Yeah. You also, I love this term you use, our listeners might as well become versed in tradecraft as well, this use of the verbal parole.
Right.
What's that?
A verbal parole is, it's almost a cliche now, but it actually is used. You see it in movies all of the time, where one spy will go up to another and say, you know, the duck flies at midnight, and the answer to that would be only in Miami, but it wouldn't be anything so ridiculous. It would be, didn't I meet you in San Jose? And the person may answer, no, I believe that was San Mateo. So anyone listening in would see it as a normal conversation.
Yeah.
But yeah. There are visual paroles also, carrying a newspaper under your left arm or a pipe in your right hand.
Mm.
And they may be used in conjunction. You see the visual parole, and then you do the verbal parole.
Yeah, yeah. Well, given current events, I want to read this last sentence from my review of your book in The Sun. We've been discussing the sort of the almost humorous side of all this. But my last sentence reads, a number of Israeli soldiers have been fooled, and the consequences have not been sweet.
Right. Hamas was a very early adapter of cyber honey traps. Dating apps and World Cup or soccer, you know, soccer tracking apps were, you know, implanted on their phones or downloaded onto their phones by Hamas. That's amazing to me.
Yeah.
You know, to create the capability of that kind of software app. These apps, by the way, some of them were downloaded from the Apple Store.
Wow. Yeah.
Right? They snuck through. It leads me to believe that there's a third party involved in the programming.
Yeah. Yeah. And so these Israeli soldiers would become involved just online or in
they would become involved. You know, online they would, you know, there would be a normal Facebook page of a pretty girl, and the girl would have been, after going back and forth, the person who was playing the girl would say, I'd like to send you some pics, but I can't do it in public. Will you download this app?
Oh.
Right. And the app would begin to download, and a thing would flash up that says, not compatible. But in effect, the app was on their phones and had taken control of their phones.
So they could sort of track the movements of certain Israeli soldiers.
They could track the movements. They can listen in, turn on the microphone and listen into their conversations. They could download all of the pictures on their phones. They could, basically they could do everything on the phone that the soldier could do.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
So you've got to be careful what you download.
Yeah, it's... You know, there's been so much discussion about an intelligence failure because of the Hamas attack. And I have to think, in the age of cyber honey traps, the word term you use in your book, there's a, I don't know how to put this, I've been thinking about this. When people say there's an intelligence failure, what does that mean? I think honey traps can tell us some of what that means. In part, though, I think with a group like Hamas, they were underestimated.
I'm not sure. I don't like to speculate on
that. Yeah, no. Yeah. I'm speculating. You know, I'm speculating that there are ideological reasons why these things happen. But it's hard. Yeah, it's hard to pin down. So what are you going to do now? Are you going to continue in the spy business?
Yes, I'm working on a couple of books. One of them is has to do with unlikely spies.
Ah.
And it's, you know, unlikely spies are often the most effective.
Sure.
Because you just never see them coming.
Yeah.
So, you know, they might be an actor. They might be a writer. They just seem so far-fetched that they would be anything but what they are, you know, that
yes.
people ignore them.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I was going to just ask you how far along you were with it.
I'm just in the proposal stages at this point.
Uh-huh.
I will say something else.
Yeah, please do, yeah.
Okay. You know, there's a mythology that goes along with, you know, people like Mata Hari and all of the rest that kind of overtakes the reality. And sometimes that's intentional. I'd note, you know, for your readers who are interested in the Civil War, that there was an enormous push of celebrity spies following the you know, the end of the Civil War.
Yeah.
And they wrote books, and they went on the lecture circuit. And much of what they wrote and much of what they lectured on was fictional. But today, it's very easy to take that as what was going on. You know, because of the age and because it's been echoed, it's very easy to believe some of those accounts.
Yeah.
Civil War spy accounts. And they would put, you know, there was a raciness that they added to their exploits. Much like James Bond, there was one Confederate spy who claimed to have hidden under the hoop skirts of Southern Belles to avoid Yankee capture. Right? There was another one who claimed, you know, a woman who claimed to dress like a man to avoid, you know, detection.
Yeah.
Right? Cross-dressing, for some reason, was seen as acceptable and racy at the same time in the post-Civil War period for spies. So there's a lot of that kind of thing. But these stories echo. You know, the books were published and the newspaper accounts were published right after the Civil War. And nobody ever, you know, thought to fact check them. The books were selling well and the newspaper, you know, and they were selling newspapers. But if you go a step further, they're completely inaccurate. It's fiction.
It's talking about this reminds me of another book I reviewed recently about Jean Le Carré and the biographer trying to figure out what is true and not true in Le Carré's life. And Le Carré say things like, well, the spy agencies never bothered me once I started publishing fiction because it was fiction. It was nothing like what it really was.
Right. I believe that. I think it was fiction. He used the genre to explore human nature.
Yes.
The way sometimes Westerns do, the way detective stories do. And he added authenticating detail. So there are dead drops, there are codes, there's surveillance, you know, to make the story seem, you know, realistic. But, you know, I think he was really exploring human nature, you know, the way the novelist does. But just dressing it up as a spy story.
Yeah. There's a funny moment, his biographer talks about him checking into a hotel and pointedly telling the clerk that he was going to walk in a certain direction and then leaving the hotel and he walks in the opposite direction. Sometimes I think he might have enjoyed playing at being a spy.
Well, he was a spy early in his career.
That's right, yeah. Service.
Yeah. So I think he did enjoy playing the spy. And I think he enjoyed their company, you know, his old comrades' company.
Yeah. It raises a larger question about both spying and about biography, and that is the whole issue of role playing. You know, the way people present themselves, which is a kind of fiction. I mean, psychologists write about this. You know, writers like Irving Goffman take the theater, you know, all the world's a stage. Quite seriously when they describe human behavior. And so when someone reads about honey traps, I think they can identify with this. This is a very human sort of thing to do.
Sure. It takes, you know, spies use, for better or for worse, they use human, you know, they use weakness, they use human traits.
Yeah.
To gain access. The old... there's a mice model, which is money, ideology, coercion, and ego. Those are how you get, you know, how you recruit an agent.
Yeah.
Right. If you want to draw the comparison between actors and spies, You could say that both tell a lie to tell the truth.
Yes. Yeah.
Right. But, not included in the mice model is the disgruntled, who often make very enthusiastic spies.
Yeah, the Benedict Arnold sort of spy.
Right, people who are unhappy, who have a grudge against either, their government or the spy agency, and they see this as a way, they see betrayal as a way of getting back at them.
Yeah.
Secret betrayal.
Yeah, that's right. Well, a lot to think about there. Is there anything I should have asked you that I didn't ask you?
No, I think that pretty much covers it. It's endlessly fascinating because when you read about spies, when you read about the history of espionage, it's not only geopolitical, but it's also the history of human nature.
Yes.
Right. It goes very deep, and it's a no nonsense. It's at its best, it doesn't sugarcoat human nature.
Yes.
Right. And I think that's true for the history of espionage, but I also think it's true for some of the fiction. Say
yep.
about Carré or Graham Greene and a few others.
Yeah. Well, I look forward to your next book.
I'm starting on it as soon as I can interest in an editor.
Yes, very good. Well, it's a pleasure talking to you, Henry.
Okay,
and I'm going to be posting this podcast, and I'll send you a link so that you can post it as well.
Great, and thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, take care now.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.